specific, apparently. I guess he felt some attachment to the place. As Clark spoke, he was remembering a conversation he'd had with Arthur over drinks some years ago, in a bar in New York. They'd been discussing the cities they'd lived in. "You're from London," Arthur had said. "A guy like you can take cities for granted. For someone like me, coming from a small place? Look, I think about my childhood, the life I lived on Delano Island. That place was so small. Everyone knew me, not because I was special or anything, just because everyone knew everyone. And the claustrophobia of that, I can't tell you. I just wanted some privacy. For as long as I could remember, I just wanted to get out. And then I got to Toronto and no one knew me. Toronto felt like freedom. And then you moved to L.A. and got famous," Clark had said, "and now everyone knows you again." "Right." Arthur had been preoccupied with an olive in his martini, trying to spear it with a toothpick. "I guess you could say Toronto was the only place I felt free." Clark woke at 4 a.m. the next morning and took a taxi to the airport. These were the hours of near misses, the hours of miracles, visible as such only in hindsight over the following days. The flu was already seeping through the city, but he hailed a taxi in which the driver wasn't ill and no one contagious had touched any surface before him, and from this improbably lucky car he watched the streets passing in the pre-dawn dark, the pale light of bodegas with their flowers behind plastic curtains, a few shift workers on the sidewalks. The social media networks were filled with rumors of the flu's arrival in New York, but Clark didn't partake of social media and was unaware. At the John F. Kennedy International Airport, he passed through a terminal in which he managed, by some choreography of luck, to avoid passing too close to anyone who was already infected. There were several infected people in that particular terminal by then, and managed not to touch any of the wrong surfaces. Managed, in fact, to board a plane filled with similarly lucky people. The 27th to last plane ever to depart from that airport. And through all of this, he was so sleep-deprived. He'd stayed up too late packing. He was tired and caught up in thoughts of Arthur, in listening to Coltrane on headphones, in working half-heartedly at the 360-degree reports once he found himself at the departure gate, that he didn't realize he was on the same flight as Elizabeth Colton, until he glanced up and saw her boarding the plane with her son. It was a coincidence, but not an enormous coincidence. On the phone the other day, he'd told her about the flight he was planning on taking, 7 a.m. to get to Toronto before the predicted snowstorm arrived and snarled the airports, and she'd said she would try to get on the same flight. And then there she was in a dark suit, her hair cut short but instantly recognizable, her son by her side. Elizabeth and Tyler were in first class, and Clark was in economy. They said hello as Clark walked past her seat, and then didn't speak again until an hour and a half after takeoff, when the pilot announced that they were being diverted into some place in Michigan that Clark had never heard of, and everyone disembarked, confused and disoriented, into the Severn City Airport. Chapter 41. After Clark had delivered the news of Arthur's death, Miranda remained on the beach for some time. She sat in the sand thinking of Arthur and watching a small boat coming into shore, a single bright light skimming over the water. She was thinking about the way she'd always taken for granted that the world had certain people in it, either central to her days or unseen and infrequently thought of. How without any one of these people, the world is a subtly but unmistakably altered place. The dial turned just 1 or 2 degrees. She was very tired, she realized, not feeling quite well, the beginnings of a sore throat, and tomorrow was another day of meetings. She'd forgotten to ask Clark about funeral arrangements, but her next thought was that, of course, she wouldn't want to go. The idea of being pinned between the paparazzi and Arthur's other ex-wives, and this was what she was thinking of as she rose and walked up the path to the hotel, which from the beach looked a little like a wedding cake, 2 tiers of white balconies. The lobby was oddly empty. There was no front desk staff. The concierge wore a surgical mask. Miranda started to approach him to ask what was going on, but the look he gave her was one of unmistakable fear. She understood, as clearly as if he'd shouted it, that he wanted very badly for her not to come near him. She backed away and walked quickly to the elevators, shaken, his gaze on her back. There was no one in the upstairs corridor. Back in her room, she opened her laptop and, for the first time all day, turned her attention to the news. Later, Miranda spent 2 hours making phone calls, but there was no way to leave by then. Every nearby airport was closed. "Listen," a fraying airline representative finally snapped at her. "Even if I could book you on a flight out of Malaysia, are you seriously telling me you'd want to spend 12 hours breathing recirculated air with 200 other people in an airplane cabin at this point?" Miranda hung up the phone. When she leaned back in the chair, her gaze fell on the air conditioning vent above the desk. The thought of air whispering through the building, propelled from room to room. It wasn't her imagination. She definitely had a sore throat. "It's psychosomatic," she said aloud. "You're afraid of getting sick, so you feel sick. It's nothing." She was trying to reframe the story as an exciting adventure. "The time I got stuck in Asia during a flu outbreak." But she was unconvinced. She spent some time sketching, trying to calm herself. A rocky island with a small house on it, lights on the horizon of Station 11's dark sea. Miranda woke at 4 in the morning with a fever. She fought it off with 3 aspirin, but her joints were knots of pain, her legs weak, her skin hurt where her clothes touched her. It was difficult to cross the room to the desk. She read the latest news on the laptop, her eyes aching from the light of the screen, and understood. She could feel the fever pressing against the thin film of aspirin. She tried calling the front desk, and then the New York and Toronto offices of Neptune Logistics, followed by the Canadian, American, British, and Australian consulates, but there were only voicemail greetings and ringing phones. Miranda rested the side of her face on the desk, the perfection of the cool laminate against her burning skin, and considered the poverty of the room. Poverty not in the economic sense, but in the sense of not being enough for the gravity of the moment, an insufficient setting. For what? She couldn't think of this just yet. And she was thinking about the beach, the ships, the lights on the horizon, if it would be possible to get there when she felt so ill. Related thoughts that perhaps if she could get there, someone on the beach might help her, that if she stayed here in the room, she'd only get sicker, and there was apparently no one at the front desk or in the consulates, all telephones, unmanned. If she became any sicker, she'd eventually be stranded here, too ill to get out of this room. There might be fishermen on the beach. She rose unsteadily. It took a long time and considerable concentration to put on her shoes. The corridor was silent. It was necessary to walk very slowly, her hand on the wall. A man was curled on his side near the elevators, shivering. She wanted to speak to him, but speaking would take too much strength, so she looked at him instead. "I see you. I see you." And hoped this was enough. The lobby was empty now. The staff had fled. Outside, the air was heavy and still, a greenish light on the horizon, the beginnings of sunrise, a feeling of moving in slow motion, like walking underwater or in a dream. It was necessary to concentrate carefully on each step, this terrible weakness. She followed the path to the beach, walking very slowly, her outstretched hands brushing the palm fronds on either side. At the bottom of the path, the hotel's white chaise longues lay in a row on the sand, unoccupied. The beach was empty of people. She collapsed into the nearest chaise longue and closed her eyes. Exhaustion. She was desperately hot, then racked with chills. Her thoughts were disordered. No one came. She was thinking about the container ship fleet on the horizon. The crew out there wouldn't have been exposed to the flu. Too late to get to a ship herself now, but she smiled at the thought that there were people in this reeling world who were safe. Miranda opened her eyes in time to see the sunrise, a wash of violent color, pink and streaks of brilliant orange, the container ships on the horizon suspended between the blaze of the sky and the water aflame, the seascape bleeding into confused visions of Station 11, its extravagant sunsets and its indigo sea. The lights of the fleet fading into morning, the ocean burning into sky. Part 7. The Terminal. Chapter 42. At first, the people in the Severn City Airport counted time as though they were only temporarily stranded. This was difficult to explain to young people in the following decades, but in all fairness, the entire history of being stranded in airports up to that point was also a history of eventually becoming unstranded, of boarding a plane and flying away. At first it seemed inevitable that the National Guard would roll in at any moment with blankets and boxes of food, that ground crews would return shortly thereafter, and planes would start landing and taking off again. Day 1, day 2, day 48, day 90, any expectation of a return to normalcy long gone by now, then year 1, year 2, year 3. Time had been reset by catastrophe. After a while they went back to the old way of counting days and months, but kept the new system of years. January 1st, year 3, March 17th, year 4, etc. Year 4 was when Clark realized this was the way the years would continue to be marked from now on, counted off one by one from the moment of disaster. He'd known for a long time by then that the world's changes wouldn't be reversed, but still, the realization cast his memories in a sharper light. The last time I ate an ice cream cone in a park in the sunlight. The last time I danced in a club. The last time I saw a moving bus. The last time I boarded an airplane that hadn't been repurposed as living quarters, an airplane that actually took off. The last time I ate an orange. Toward the end of his second decade in the airport, Clark was thinking about how lucky he'd been. Not just the mere fact of survival, which was, of course, remarkable in and of itself, but to have seen one world end and another begin. And not just to have seen the remembered splendors of the former world, the space shuttles and the electrical grid and the amplified guitars, the computers that could be held in the palm of a hand, and the high-speed trains between cities, but to have lived among those wonders for so long, to have dwelt in that spectacular world for 51 years of his life. Sometimes he lay awake in Concourse B of the Severn City Airport and thought, I was there, and the thought pierced him through with an admixture of sadness and exhilaration. It's hard to explain, he caught himself saying sometimes to young people who came into his museum, which had formerly been the Sky Miles Lounge in Concourse C. But he took his role as curator seriously, and he'd decided years ago that it's hard to explain isn't good enough, so he always tried to explain it all anyway, whenever anyone asked about any of the objects he'd collected over the years, from the airport and beyond, the laptops, the iPhones, the radio from an administrative desk, the electric toaster from an airport staff lounge, the turntable and vinyl records that some optimistic scavenger had carried back from Severn City, and of course the context, the pre-pandemic world that he remembered so sharply. No, he was explaining now to a 16-year-old who'd been born in the airport, the planes didn't rise straight up into the sky. They gathered speed on long runways and angled upward. Why did they need the runways? The 16-year-old asked. Her name was Emmanuelle. He had a special fondness for her, because he remembered her birth as the only good thing that had happened in that terrible first year. They couldn't get off the ground without gathering speed. They needed momentum. "Oh," she said, "the engines weren't that powerful then?" "They were," he said, "but they weren't like rocket ships." "Rocket ships? The ships we used to go to space." "It's incredible," she said, shaking her head. "Yes. Incredible in retrospect, all of it, but especially the parts having to do with travel and communications. This was how he arrived in this airport. He'd boarded a machine that transported him at high speed a mile above the surface of the Earth. This was how he'd told Miranda Carroll of her ex-husband's death. He'd pressed a series of buttons on a device that had connected him within seconds to an instrument on the other side of the world. And Miranda, barefoot on a white sand beach, with a shipping fleet shining before her in the dark, had pressed a button that had connected her via satellite to New York. These taken-for-granted miracles that had persisted all around them. By the end of the second decade, most of the airport's population was either born there or had walked in later, but 24 or so people remained who had been there since the day their flights had landed. Clark's flight landed without incident, diverted from Toronto for reasons no one seemed immediately able to explain, and taxied to a gate in Concourse B. Clark looked up from his edits of the 360-degree subordinates report and was struck by the variety of planes on the tarmac. Singapore Airlines, Cathay Pacific, Air Canada, Lufthansa, Air France, enormous jets parked end to end. When Clark emerged from the jet bridge into the fluorescent light of Concourse B, the first thing he noticed was the uneven distribution of people. Crowds had gathered beneath the television monitors. Clark decided that whatever they were looking at, he couldn't face it without a cup of tea. He assumed it was a terrorist attack. He bought a cup of Earl Grey at a kiosk and took his time adding the milk. "This is the last time I'll stir milk into my tea without knowing what happened," he thought, wistful in advance for the present moment, and went to stand with the crowd beneath a television that was tuned to CNN. The story of the pandemic's arrival in North America had broken while he was in the air. This was another thing that was hard to explain years later, but up until that morning, the Georgia flu had seemed quite distant, especially if one happened not to be on social media. Clark had never followed the news very closely, and had actually heard about the flu only the day before the flight, in a brief newspaper story about a mysterious outbreak of some virus in Paris, and it hadn't been at all clear that it was developing into a pandemic. But now he watched the too-late evacuations of cities, the riots outside hospitals on three continents, the slow-moving exodus clogging every road, and wished he'd been paying more attention. The gridlocked roads were puzzling, because where were all these people going? If these reports were to be believed, not only had the Georgia flu arrived, but it was already everywhere. There were clips of officials from various governments, epidemiologists with their sleeves rolled up, everyone wan and bloodshot and warning of catastrophe, blue-black circles under bloodshot eyes. "It's not looking promising for a quick end to the emergency," a newscaster said, understating the situation to a degree previously unmatched in the history of understatement, and then he blinked at the camera, and something in him seemed to stutter. A breaking down of some mechanism that had previously held his personal and professional lives apart, and he addressed the camera with a new urgency. "Mel," he said, "if you're watching this, sweetheart, take the kids to your parents' ranch. Back roads only, my love. No highways. I love you so much." "It must be nice to have the network at your disposal," a man standing near Clark said. "I don't know where my wife is either. You know where your wife is?" His voice carried a high note of panic. Clark decided to pretend that the man had asked him where his boyfriend was. "No," he said, "I have no idea." He turned away from the monitor, unable to bear another second of the news. For how long had he been standing here? His tea had gone cold. He drifted down the concourse and stood before the flight status monitors. Every flight had been canceled. How had all of this happened so quickly? Why hadn't he checked the news before he left for the airport? It occurred to Clark that he should call someone, actually everyone, that he should call everyone he'd ever loved and talk to them and tell them all the things that mattered. But it was apparently already too late for this, his phone displaying a message he'd never seen before. System overload, emergency calls only. He bought another tea, because the first one had gone cold, and also he was beset now by terrible fears, and walking to the kiosk seemed like purposeful action. Also because the two young women working the kiosk seemed profoundly unconcerned by what was unfolding on CNN. Either that, or they were extremely stoic, or they hadn't noticed yet. So visiting them was like going back in time to the paradise of a half hour earlier, when he hadn't yet known that everything was coming undone. Can you tell us more about the, well, about what people should be looking out for, the symptoms? The newscaster asked. Same things we see every flu season, the epidemiologist said. Just worse. So, for example, aches and pains, a sudden high fever, difficulty breathing. Look, the epidemiologist said, it's a fast incubation period. If you're exposed, you're sick in 3 or 4 hours and dead in a day or two. We're going to take a quick commercial break, the newscaster said. The airline staff had no information. They were tight-lipped and frightened. They distributed food vouchers, which, by power of suggestion, made everyone hungry, so passengers formed lines to buy greasy cheese quesadillas and nacho plates at Concourse B's only restaurant, which was ostensibly Mexican. The two young women in the kiosk continued to serve hot drinks and mildly stale baked goods, frowning every so often at their useless phones. Clark bought his way into the Sky Miles lounge and found Elizabeth Colton in an armchair near a television screen. Tyler sat cross-legged on the floor nearby, killing space aliens on a Nintendo console. It's crazy, Clark said to Elizabeth, words falling hopelessly short. She was watching the news, her hands clasped at her throat. It's unprecedented, Elizabeth said. In all of human history. She trailed off, shaking her head. Tyler groaned softly. He'd suffered a setback in the alien wars. They sat for a while in silence, watching, until Clark couldn't watch anymore and excused himself to find more nachos. A final plane was landing, an air gradient jet, but as Clark watched, it made a slow turn on the tarmac and moved away from instead of toward the terminal building. It parked in the far distance, and no ground crew went to meet it. Clark abandoned his nachos and went to the window. It occurred to him that the air gradient jet was as far away from the terminal as it could possibly go. This was where he was standing when the announcement came. For public health reasons, the airport was closing immediately. There would be no flights for the indefinite future. All passengers were asked to collect their bags at baggage claim, to leave the premises in an orderly fashion, and to please not flip out. This can't be happening, the passengers said to each other and to themselves, over nacho platters and in angry clusters in front of vending machines. They swore at airport management, at the TSA, at the airlines, at their useless phones, furious. Because fury was the last defense against understanding what the news stations were reporting. Beneath the fury was something literally unspeakable, the television news carrying an implication that no one could yet bring themselves to consider. It was possible to comprehend the scope of the outbreak, but it wasn't possible to comprehend what it meant. Clark stood by the terminal's glass wall in the Mexican restaurant, watching the stillness of the air gradient jet in the far distance, and he realized later that if he didn't understand at that moment why it was out there alone, it was only because he didn't want to know. The workers at the restaurants and the gift shop chased out their customers and locked down steel shutters and gates, walked away without looking back. The passengers around Clark began departing too, an exodus that merged with the slow processions leaving the other two concourses. Elizabeth and Tyler emerged from the Sky Miles lounge. "Are you leaving?" Clark asked. It still wasn't entirely real.
"Not yet," Elizabeth said.
She looked a little deranged, but so did everyone else.
"Where should we go? You saw the news."
Everyone who'd been watching the news knew that roads everywhere were impassable, cars abandoned where they'd run out of gas, all commercial airlines shut down, no trains or buses. Most of them were leaving the airport anyway, because the voice over the intercom had said that they should.
"I think I'll stay here for the moment," Clark said. A few others apparently had had the same thought, and some who'd left returned after a half hour with reports that there was no ground transportation. The others had set out walking for Severn City, they said. Clark waited for an airport official to come and chase all of them away, the 100-odd passengers who remained at the terminal, but none did. An Air Gradia agent was in tears by the ticket counter. The screen over her head still read, "Air Gradia Flight 452 now arriving," but when her radio crackled, Clark heard the word, "Quarantine." Half of the remaining passengers had tied scarves or t-shirts over their mouths and noses, but it had been hours by now, and if they were all going to die of flu, Clark thought, wouldn't at least some of them be sick already? The passengers who remained in the airport were mostly foreign. They looked out the windows at the airplanes on which they'd arrived, Cathay Pacific, Lufthansa, Singapore Airlines, Air France, parked end-to-end on the tarmac. They spoke in languages Clark didn't understand. A little girl did cartwheels up and down the length of Concourse B. Clark walked the length of the airport, restless, and was stunned to see that the security checkpoints were unmanned. He walked through and back three or four times, just because he could. He'd thought it would be liberating, but all he felt was fear. He found himself staring at everyone he saw, looking for symptoms. No one seemed sick, but could they be carrying it? He found a corner as far from his fellow passengers as possible, and stayed there for some time.
"We just have to wait," Elizabeth said when he came to sit with her again. "Surely by tomorrow morning we'll see the National Guard."
Arthur had always liked her optimism, Clark remembered. No one emerged from the Air Gradia jet on the tarmac. A young man was doing push-ups by gate B20. He'd do a set of 10, then lie on his back and stare unblinking at the ceiling for a while, then another 10, etc. Clark found a discarded New York Times on a bench and read Arthur's obituary. Noted film and stage actor, dead at 51. A life summed up in a series of failed marriages, Miranda, Elizabeth, Lydia, and a son, whose present absorption in his handheld Nintendo was absolute. When Arthur collapsed on stage, someone from the audience had performed CPR, the obituary said, but that audience member remained unidentified. Clark folded the paper into his suitcase. Clark's grasp of Midwestern American geography was shaky. He wasn't entirely sure where he was. He'd gathered from the items on offer at the souvenir shop that they were somewhere near Lake Michigan, which he could picture because he retained an internal bird's-eye snapshot of the Great Lakes from his time in Toronto, but he'd never heard of Severn City. The airport seemed very new. Beyond the tarmac and the runways, he could see only a line of trees. He tried to pinpoint his location on his iPhone, but the map wouldn't load. No one's phones were working, but word spread that there was a payphone down in baggage claim. Clark stood in line for a half hour and then dialed all his numbers, but there were only busy signals and endless ringing. Where was everyone?
The man behind him in line sighed loudly, so Clark gave up the phone and spent some time wandering the airport. When he was tired of walking, he returned to a bench he'd staked out earlier by gate B-17, lay on his back on the carpet between the bench and a wall of glass. Snow began to fall in the late afternoon. Elizabeth and Tyler were still in the Sky Miles lounge. He knew he should be sociable and talk to them, but he wanted to be alone, or as alone as he could be in an airport with 100 other terrified and weeping people. He ate a dinner of corn chips and chocolate bars from a vending machine, spent some time listening to Coltrane on his iPod. He was thinking of Robert, his boyfriend of 3 months. Clark wanted very much to see him again. What was Robert doing at this moment? Clark stared up at the news. Around 10 p.m., he brushed his teeth, returned to his spot by gate B-17, stretched out on the carpet, and tried to imagine he was home in his bed. He woke at 3 in the morning, shivering. The news had worsened. The fabric was unraveling. It will be hard to come back from this, he thought, because in those first days it was still inconceivable that civilization might not come back from this at all. Clark was watching NBC when a teenager approached him. He'd noticed her earlier, sitting by herself with her head in her hands. She looked about 17 and had a diamond nose stud that caught the light. I'm sorry to ask, she said, but do you have any Effexor?
Effexor?
I've run out, she said. I'm asking everyone.
I'm sorry, I haven't any. What is it?
An antidepressant, the girl said. I thought I'd be home in Arizona by now.
I'm so sorry. How awful for you.
Well, the girl said, thanks anyway. And Clark watched her walk away to make inquiries of a couple only slightly older than she was, who listened for a moment and then shook their heads in unison. Clark was thinking ahead to a time when he'd sit with Robert in a restaurant in New York or London, and they'd raise a glass of wine to their tremendous good fortune at having made it through. How many of their friends would have died by the time he saw Robert again? There would be funerals to go to, memorial services, probably a certain measure of grief and survivor's guilt to contend with, therapy and such. What a terrible time that was, Clark said softly to an imaginary Robert, practicing for the future. Awful, imaginary Robert agreed. Remember those days when you were in the airport and I didn't know where you were? Clark closed his eyes. The news continued on the overhead screens, but he couldn't bear to watch. The stacked body bags, the riots, the closed hospitals, the dead-eyed refugees walking on interstates. Think of anything else. If not the future, the past. Dancing with Arthur when they were young in Toronto. The taste of Orange Julius, that sugary orange drink he'd only ever tasted in Canadian shopping malls. The scar on Robert's arm just above the elbow, from when he'd broken his arm very badly in the 7th grade. The bouquet of tiger lilies that Robert had sent to Clark's office just last week. Robert, in the mornings, he liked to read a novel while he ate breakfast. It was possibly the most civilized habit Clark had ever encountered. Was Robert awake at this moment? Was he trying to leave New York? The storm had passed, and snow lay deep on the wings of airplanes. There were no de-icing machines, no tire tracks, no footprints. The ground workers had departed. Air Gradia 452 was still alone on the tarmac. There was a moment later in the day when Clark blinked and realized he'd been staring into space for some time. He had intimations of danger, that there was hazard in allowing his thoughts to drift too loosely, so he tried to work, to read over his 360-degree reports, but his thoughts were scattered, and also he couldn't help but wonder if the target of the 360-degree and all the people he'd interviewed were dead. He tried to reread his newspapers on the theory that this required less concentration than the reports, came across Arthur's New York Times obituary again, and realized that the world in which Arthur had died already seemed quite distant. He'd lost his oldest friend, but if the television news was accurate,
that in all probability, everyone here with him in the airport had lost someone too. All at once he felt an aching tenderness for his fellow refugees, these 100 or so strangers here in the airport. He folded his paper and looked at them, his compatriots, sleeping or fretfully awake on benches and on carpets, pacing, staring at screens or out at the landscape of airplanes and snow. Everyone waiting for whatever came next. Chapter 43. The first winter in the Severn City Airport. There was a frisson of excitement on day two when someone recognized Elizabeth and Tyler and word spread. "My phone," Clark heard a young man say in frustration. He was about 20, with hair that flopped in his eyes. "God, why won't our phones work? I so wish I could tweet this."
"Yeah," his girlfriend said, wistful. "You know, like, not much, just chilling with Arthur Leander's kid at the end of the world."
"Totally," the man said. Clark moved away from them in order to maintain his sanity, although later, in a more charitable moment, it occurred to him that they were probably in shock. By day three, all the vending machines in the airport were empty of snacks, and the battery on Tyler's Nintendo console was dead. Tyler wept, inconsolable. The girl who needed Effexor was very sick by then. "Withdrawal," she said. No one in the airport had the drugs she needed. A raiding party went through every room, the administrative offices and the TSA holding cell, everyone's desk drawers, and then they went outside and broke into the dozen or so cars abandoned in the parking lot, pawed through glove boxes and trunks. They found some useful items in their searches, extra pairs of shoes and some warm clothes and such, but on the pharmaceutical front they uncovered only painkillers and antacids, and a mysterious bottle of pills that someone thought might be for stomach ulcers. In the meantime, the girl lay across a bench, shivering and drenched in sweat, and she said her head sparked with electricity every time she moved. They called 911 from the payphone in baggage claim, but no one picked up. They wandered outside and stared at the snowed-in parking lot, the airport road disappearing into the trees. But what could possibly be out there aside from the flu? The television newscasters weren't exactly saying that it was the end of the world, per se, but the word apocalypse was beginning to appear. "All those people," Clark said to Imaginary Robert, but Imaginary Robert didn't reply. That evening they broke into the Mexican restaurant and cooked an enormous dinner of ground meat and tortilla chips and cheese with sauces splashed over it. Some people had mixed feelings about this. They'd obviously been abandoned here. Everyone was hungry and 911 wasn't even operational. On the other hand, no one wants to be a thief. But then a business traveler named Mac said, "Look, everyone just chill the fuck out. I'll cover it on my Amex." There was applause at this announcement. He removed his Amex card from his wallet with a flourish and left it next to the cash register, where it remained untouched for the next 97 days. On day four, the food from the Mexican restaurant ran out, also the food from the sandwich place in Concourse C. That night they lit their first bonfire on the tarmac, burning newspapers and magazines from the newsstand and a wooden bench from Concourse A. Someone had raided the Sky Miles Lounge. They got drunk on Sky Miles Lounge champagne and ate Sky Miles Lounge oranges and snack mix. Someone suggested that perhaps a passing plane or helicopter might see the fire and come down to save them. But no lights crossed the cloudless sky. The realization, later, that that had possibly been his last orange.
"This orangeless world," Clark said to himself, or perhaps to Imaginary Robert, and laughed in a way that prompted concerned glances from the others. That first year, everyone was a little crazy. On day five, they broke into the gift shop,
because some people had no clean clothes, and after that, at any given moment, half of the population was dressed in bright red or blue, beautiful Northern Michigan t-shirts. They washed their clothes in the sinks, and everywhere Clark turned he saw laundry hanging to dry on the backs of benches. The effect was oddly cheerful, like strings of bright flags. The snacks from Concourse B gift shop were gone by day 6. The National Guard still hadn't arrived. On day 7, the networks began to blink off the air, one by one. "So that all of our employees may be with their families," a CNN anchor said, ashen and glassy-eyed after 48 hours without sleep. "We are temporarily suspending broadcast operations." "Good night," NBC said an hour later. "And good luck." CBS switched without comment to reruns of America's Got Talent. This was at 5 in the morning, and everyone who was awake watched for a few hours. It was nice to take a quick break from the end of the world. And then, in the early afternoon, the lights went out. They came back on almost immediately, but what it probably meant, a pilot said, was that the grid had gone down and the airport had switched to generator power. All of the workers who knew how the generators worked had left by then. People had been trickling out since day 3. "It's the waiting," Clark had heard a woman say. "I can't take the waiting. I have to do something, even if it's just walking to the nearest town to see what's going on." A TSA agent had remained at the airport, just one, Tyrone, and he knew how to hunt. By day 8, no one new had come to the airport, and no one who'd left had returned. No more planes or helicopters had landed. Everyone was hungry and trying not to think about all the apocalypse movies they'd seen over the years. Tyrone set off into the trees with a woman who'd formerly been a park ranger and 2 TSA-issue handguns, and they returned sometime later with a deer. They strung it between metal chairs over the fire, and at sunset everyone ate roasted venison and drank the last of the champagne, while the girl who needed a fixer slipped out through an entrance on the other side of the airport and walked away into the trees. A group of them tried to find her, but couldn't. The girl who needed a fixer had left her suitcase and all of her belongings behind, including her driver's license. She looked sleepy in the picture, a slightly younger version of herself with longer hair. Her name was Lily Patterson. She was 18. No one knew what to do with the driver's license. Finally, someone put it on the counter of the Mexican restaurant, next to Max's Amex card. Tyler spent his days curled in an armchair in the Sky Miles lounge, reading his comic books over and over again. Elizabeth sat near him with her eyes closed, lips moving constantly, rapidly, in some repeated prayer. The televisions displayed silent test patterns. On the 12th day in the airport, the lights went out, but the toilets would still flush if one poured water into the bowls, so they collected plastic trays from the security checkpoints and filled them with snow, carted these to the restrooms to melt. Clark had never thought much about airport design, but he was grateful that so much of this particular airport was glass. They lived in daylight and went to bed at sundown. There were 3 pilots among the stranded. On the 15th day in the airport, one of them announced that he'd decided to take a plane to Los Angeles. The snow had melted, so he thought he could maybe make do without de-icing machines. People reminded him that Los Angeles had looked pretty bad on the news. "Yeah, but everywhere looked bad on the news," the pilot said. His family was in L.A. He wasn't willing to accept the possibility of not seeing them again. "Anyone wants to come with me?" he said. "It's a free flight to Los Angeles." This alone seemed like proof that the world was ending, because this was the era when people were being charged extra for checked bags, for boarding early enough to cram baggage into overhead bins before the bins filled up, for the privilege of sitting in exit rows with their life-or-death stakes and their 2 extra inches of leg room. The passengers exchanged glances. "The plane's fueled up,"
the pilot said. I was flying Boston to San Diego when we got diverted, and it's not like it'll be a full flight.
It occurred to Clark that if the entire population of the airport went with him, there would still be empty seats on the plane.
I'm going to give you all a day to think about it, the pilot said, but I'm flying out tomorrow before the temperature drops again.
There were, of course, no guarantees. There had been no news from the outside world since the televisions went dark, and there were reeling moments when it seemed possible, not likely, but possible, that the 79 of them left there in the airport might be the last people alive on Earth. For all anyone knew, LAX was a heap of smoking rubble. Agonized calculations were performed. Almost everyone who lived west of the Rockies approached the pilot. Most of the people who lived in Asia opted to take the flight, which would still leave an ocean between themselves and their loved ones, but would at least bring them 2,000 miles closer to home. At noon the next day, the passengers boarded via a wheeled staircase they'd found in a hangar, and a crowd gathered on the tarmac to watch the plane depart. The sound of the engines was startling after these days of silence. There was a long period when nothing happened, the engines roaring, before the plane worked its way out of the line of parked aircraft with a series of delicate lurching turns. It left a gap between the Cathay Pacific and Lufthansa jets and made a slow curve to the runway. Someone, impossible to see who at this distance, was waving in one of the windows. A few people waved back. The plane started down the runway, gathered speed, the wheels left the ground, and the watchers held their breaths for the moment of ascent. But the machine didn't falter. It rose instead of falling. And as it receded into the clear blue sky, Clark realized he had tears on his face. Why, in his life of frequent travel, had he never recognized the beauty of flight, the improbability of it? The sound of the engines faded, the airplane receding into blue until it was folded into silence and became a far distant dot in the sky. Clark watched until it disappeared. That night no one had much to say around the fire. 54 of them now, the ones who'd decided against Los Angeles. The venison was too tough. Everyone chewed silently. Tyler, who seemed to almost never speak, stood close by Elizabeth and stared into the flames. Clark glanced at his watch. The plane had departed 5 hours ago. It was nearing the western edge of the continent, or it had been forced to land on an unlit runway somewhere short of California, or it had plummeted into some dark landscape in flames. It would land in Los Angeles, and the passengers would walk out into a different world, or it would land and be overcome by a mob, or it would crash into runways clogged with other planes. The passengers would find their families again, or they wouldn't. Was there still electricity in Los Angeles? All those solar panels in the southern light? All his memories of that city. Miranda at the dinner party, smoking outside while her husband flirted with his next wife. Arthur sunning himself by the pool, a pregnant Elizabeth dozing by his side.
I can't wait till things get back to normal, she said now, shivering in the firelight.
And Clark could think of absolutely nothing to say. The departure of the Los Angeles flight left two pilots, Stephen and Roy. Roy announced his intention to fly out the day after the Los Angeles flight departed.
Just reconnaissance, he said. I figure I'll fly up to Marquette. I've got a buddy up there. I'll take a look around, try to get some information on what's going on, maybe get some supplies, and come back.
He left alone the next morning in a small plane. He didn't return.
It just doesn't make sense, Elizabeth insisted. Are we supposed to believe that civilization has just come to an end?
Well, Clark offered, it was always a little fragile, wouldn't you say? They were sitting together in the Sky Miles lounge, where Elizabeth and Tyler had set up camp.
I don't know.
Elizabeth spoke slowly, looking out at the tarmac.
I've been taking art history classes on and off for years, between projects, and of course art history is always pressed up close against
non-art history. You see catastrophe after catastrophe, terrible things. All these moments when everyone must have thought the world was ending. But all those moments, they were all temporary. It always passes.
Clark was silent. He didn't think this would pass.
Elizabeth began telling him about a book she'd read once, years ago, when she'd been stuck, but not this stuck, obviously, in an airport. And it was a vampire book, actually. Not her usual sort of thing, but it had a device she kept thinking of.
The setup was post-apocalyptic, she said, so you naturally assumed, as you were reading it, that the world had ended, all of it. But then it became clear through an ingenious flash-forward device that actually it wasn't all of civilization that was lost. It was just North America, which had been placed under quarantine to keep the vampirism from spreading.
I don't think this is a quarantine, Clark said. I think there's actually really nothing out there, or at least nothing good.
There were, in fact, a number of solid arguments against the quarantine theory, namely that the pandemic had started in Europe. The last news reports had indicated chaos and disarray on every continent except Antarctica. And anyway, how would one even go about isolating North America in the first place, given air travel and the fact that South America was, after all, more or less attached? But Elizabeth was unshakable in her convictions.
Everything happens for a reason, she said. This will pass. Everything passes.
Clark couldn't bring himself to argue with her. Clark was careful to shave every 3 days. The men's rooms were windowless, lit only by an ever-dwindling supply of scented candles from the gift shop, and the water had to be warmed over the fire outside. But Clark felt it was worth the effort. Several of the men in the airport weren't shaving at all anymore, and the effect was wild, and also, frankly, unflattering. Clark disliked the general state of unshavenness, partly for aesthetic reasons, and partly because he was a believer in the broken windows theory of urban crime management, the way the appearance of dereliction can pave the way for more serious crimes. On day 27, he parted his hair neatly down the middle and shaved off the left side. It's the haircut I had from ages 17 through 19, he told Dolores when she raised an eyebrow at him. Dolores was a business traveler, single, no family, which meant that she was one of the saner people in the airport. She and Clark had an agreement. She'd promised to tell him if he began showing signs of having lost his mind, and vice versa. What he didn't tell her was that after all these years of corporate respectability, the haircut made him feel like himself again. The maintenance of sanity required some recalibrations having to do with memory and sight. There were things Clark trained himself not to think about. Everyone he'd ever known outside the airport, for instance. And here at the airport, Air Gradia 452, silent in the distance near the perimeter fence, by unspoken agreement, never discussed. Clark tried not to look at it, and sometimes almost managed to convince himself that it was empty, like all of the other planes out there. Don't think of that unspeakable decision, to keep the jet sealed rather than expose a packed airport to a fatal contagion. Don't think about what enforcing that decision may have required.
Don't think about those last few hours on board.
Snow fell every few days after Roy left, but Elizabeth insisted on keeping a runway clear at all times. She was beginning to stare in a terrible way that made everyone afraid of her, so at first she was out there alone, shoveling the snow on runway 7 by the hour. But then a few people went out to join her, because celebrity still carried a certain currency, and there she was, all alone out there, gorgeous and single. And also, why not? Physical labor outdoors was preferable to wandering the same hatefully unchanging concourses, or sitting around thinking about all the beloved people they were never going to see again, or convincing themselves they heard voices coming from the Air Gradia jet. Eventually, there were 9 or 10 people maintaining the runway, a core group who attracted volunteers from the periphery every now and again.
Why not, though, really? Even if Elizabeth's quarantine theory was too wonderful to be true, the idea that somewhere things continued on as before, untouched by the virus, children going to school and to birthday parties, and adults going to work and meeting for cocktails in some other place, everyone talking about what a shame it was that North America had been lost. But then the conversation eventually turning to sports, politics, the weather. There was still the military, with its secrets and its underground shelters, its stockpiles of fuel and medicine and food.
"They'll need a clear runway to land on when they come for us," Elizabeth said. "They're going to come for us. You know that, right?"
"It's possible," Clark said, trying to be kind. "If anyone was coming for us," Dolores said, "I think they'd be here by now."
But they did see an aircraft after the collapse, just one. On day 65, a helicopter crossed the sky in the far distance, the faintest vibration of sound moving rapidly from north to south, and they stood staring for some time after it passed. They kept up a vigil for a while after that, waiting outside in teams of two with brightly colored T-shirts to flag down aircraft in daylight, a signal fire burning all night. But nothing crossed the sky except birds and shooting stars. The night sky was brighter than it had been. On the clearest nights, the stars were a cloud of light across the breadth of the sky, extravagant in their multitudes. When Clark first noticed this, he wondered if he was possibly hallucinating. He assumed he held deep reservoirs of unspeakable damage that might at any moment blossom into insanity, the way his grandmother's bone cancer had bloomed dark over the X-rays in her final months. But after a couple of weeks, he felt that the thing with the stars was too consistent to be a hallucination, also too extreme, the way the airplanes cast shadows even when the moon was only a sliver. So he risked mentioning it to Dolores.
"It's not your imagination," Dolores said. He'd begun to think of her as his closest friend. They'd spent a pleasantly companionable day indoors, cleaning, and now they were helping build a bonfire with branches someone had dragged in from the woods. She explained it to him. One of the great scientific questions of Galileo's time was whether the Milky Way was made up of individual stars. Impossible to imagine this ever having been in question in the age of electricity, but the night sky was a wash of light in Galileo's age, and it was a wash of light now. The era of light pollution had come to an end. The increasing brilliance meant the grid was failing, darkness pooling over the earth. "I was here for the end of electricity." The thought sent shivers up Clark's spine.
"The lights will come back on someday," Elizabeth kept insisting, "and then we'll all finally get to go home."
But was there actually any reason to believe this?
The citizens of the airport had taken to meeting at the bonfire every night, an unspoken tradition that Clark hated and loved. What he loved was the conversation, the moments of lightness, or even just silence, the not being by himself. But sometimes the small circle of people and firelight seemed only to accentuate the emptiness of the continent, the loneliness of it, a candle flickering in vast darkness.
It's surprising how quickly the condition of living out of a carry-on suitcase on a bench by a departure gate can begin to seem normal. Tyler wore a sweater of Elizabeth's that went to his knees, the increasingly filthy sleeves rolled up. He kept to himself mostly, reading his comic books or Elizabeth's copy of the New Testament. They traded languages. By day 80, most of the people who'd arrived without English were learning it in informal groups, and the English speakers were studying one or more of the languages carried here by Lufthansa, Singapore Airlines, Cathay Pacific, and Air France. Clark was learning French from Annette, who'd been a Lufthansa flight attendant. He whispered phrases to himself as he went about the chores of daily existence, the hauling of water and washing of clothes in the sink, learning to skin a deer, building bonfires, cleaning.
Je m'appelle Clark. J'habite dans l'aéroport. Tu me manques. Tu me manques. Tu me manques.
A rape on the night of day 85. The airport woken after midnight by a woman's scream. They tied the man up until sunrise and then drove him into the forest at gunpoint.